Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
I think I'll need it. Hey, mate. You know, you're going to use it?
He's taping.
Oh, he's taping. Oh, you're taping it. Oh, I see. Will it pick it up there? Can you find seats? We're ready to go.
If she makes a slip, it'll be recorded.
I can't take with this family to order a coffee.
Yes, they have got that.
Why is there all no... I've known so long, but I can't think of anything. And I met the girl today, Ron, and the boy said, I saw you too.
Somebody remarked, we're not used to being running out of chairs here. This is a good sign. We're very happy to have so many people here. Before the program is introduced, I want to make a few announcements to remind you of what is coming up in March. On March 8th, the Friends of the Library, Harvey Library, will be sponsoring, along with the City Library, plant and bake sale. We did this last year for the first time, and it tended to work out pretty well. We actually made a little money, something like $70 a piece, I think. Pretty good. So we have decided to do it again this year, and I would hope that all of you will feel generous about that time and give us baked goods of one kind or another, or plants, or both. And then come and buy them back again. It will be held as it was last year during barbershop days, you remember, last year. It will be in front of the City Library. That seems to be a good place. It catches people as they're going up and down watching the parade and so on. So that will be coming up. And again, in April, we will be having another meeting such as this, which will be our annual meeting, but we always have a program too at the same time. So you will be informed, those of you who are members of the Friends of the Library. If there's anyone here who isn't, you certainly would be welcome. We will welcome your $1 fee that you have to pay to be a member. I notice our treasurer isn't here tonight, so I can't ask him for a financial report. But we...
He said he'd be late.
Oh, okay, well, okay. I guess it doesn't matter too much. We still have a little bit, little money left, don't we, after you spend all of it, Dan? We have made a few purchases within the last year. You want to talk about those?
This isn't complete, but this is one of the prints that the friend agreed to buy. What is her name? Well, I forget her name. Catherine Colline. And this is the kind of frame we're going to get. I just have the glass in yet. But they're really nice. They're woodblock prints and all sorts of different mediums. Jan Steele picked them out, and he picked out a variety of words, and there's six of them. So we'll put them in the lounge, probably, but we'll use them as an identification. So thank you very much.
This was a pretty good deal because just a matter of transferring the money from one account to another. We paid for the prints, and the artist gave the money back to the university to use the scholarship, so it was a nice deal. Probably cost us about $300, out of something like 600, I believe we had. So we're not bad financial shape, but you can use your memberships each year to help us. And we do have these few activities that we engage in. You remember we had a children's book fair in November, which was successful, although not any of them that we've had so far has made a lot of money. We sold quite a few books, more this year, I think, than we ever have before. I don't have a report on how much we made, since the bookstore manager hasn't given me the information yet. But she will eventually. Our vice president is taking off in a few days for England for 6 months. So, you know what we're going to do next spring, whether we'll be able to elect her as president. She would be in line for it. She wants to be. I'll have to ask her before she leaves. I think we're ready to start our program, and I'm very happy to be able to present our speaker tonight, Dr. Margaret Gilbert, Peg, as most of us call her, has spent several years now doing research on Forest Grove as it used to be, mostly 19th century, I presume, but perhaps running over into the early 20th, too. She has looked far and wide in this area for information. Some of the sources that she has used are on display here tonight. She's going to talk to us about 19th century Forest Grove, and particularly the sources. Where does one find the information? How do you go about it? Peg Gilbert.
My purpose is to, well, I have given several talks on 19th century Forest Grove history. And frequently, one or sometimes more than one person will come up afterwards and ask, where do you find all this stuff? I would like to do that. I have become so tied up in the last 10 years and in working on it just from curiosity. There are always more things I need to find out or things that don't fit. And so it begins to look doubtful if I will live long enough to put it all together in writing, you see. So, because I think I'm going to keep on hunting for answers. So, my purpose tonight is to interest somebody else who to work on it too, and to have that they will be able to do it more efficiently. I started out for general purpose, with a general interest or curiosity about the history of Oregon, and then a lot of flukes, one after another, have led me down to 19th century Forest Grove history. I haven't gone beyond 1900. For one thing, there are too many people living in town who were here, so I don't want to get into that period, you see. I figure that I'm relatively safe sticking to the 19th century. And the other is that so little seems to be known about it. There are a lot of descendants of original settlers of Forest Grove who live here, who have family histories, and know a good bit, particularly about this century. What I want to do tonight is to show you, point out what the sources of information are. There are a lot, I found now, that there are a lot of sources of information in Forest Grove, and a number of them I have brought here and put them here tonight so I can point them out to you. And I have made a bibliography of both the primary and secondary sources that I have found most useful. And I'm going to have given a copy of that to each this library and the city library, or if there's anyone who really wants one of their for themselves, if they will just ask me, I will Xerox a copy for it. Forest Grove is an unusually, we have advantages in studying 19th century history, Oregon history in Forest Grove, as I was told soon after I started by Mr. Robert Benson, who is probably the historian of all of Washington County. And he said that I was lucky to be in Forest Grove and doing Forest Grove because it was one of the very few places in the state of Oregon that had libraries that had never burned down. Because fire in the 19th century was very common. Now, the city library building was burned down in the 1920 fire, but it took long enough before the fire got as far as the library corner that they moved the books all out onto the campus, is what I had read. And so the books were saved. And as far as I know, the college library was never burned. So that we do have a lot of old and valuable books here, as I will try to point out. The second reason it's a good place to study 19th century history is, as I said, there are descendants of quite a number of the settlers of the first decade or two who are here. There are some in the audience, Margaret Williams and Williams here. He is a descendant of a Lansom Hinman, one of the early settlers in Forest Grove. And there are quite a number of others in town, and they have papers, diaries, because the 19th century Oregonians were kept diaries, a lot of them. There are quite a lot of diaries. A third reason that we're interested, or that Forest Grove is a lucky place to study it, is that 19th century Forest Grove is still here in many ways. 2 years ago, there was a committee that made a study of the old 19th century, the old houses and business buildings in Forest Grove as a part of the LCDC comprehensive planning process. And I have a copy of that report here somewhere, there on that corner, with pictures and lists of the old houses. And we very rapidly, in the space of about 3 weeks, got a list of 50 houses that were built in the 19th century and are still in use, and many of them very elegant houses. And Gladys Haynes studied the downtown buildings and found 13 buildings that were built in the 1890s and that are still here in use. So that a lot of the evidence, the physical evidence of 19th century Forest Grove is still present in this town, more than in many places in Oregon. And then we have the Gay 90s as our special celebration, and this I have now discovered has a peculiar importance and relevance to Forest Grove, because as I worked through the history by decades, which is what I did, Forest Grove from 1890 on is an entirely, well, is quite different. It's a city, for one thing, legally. That is, it becomes a city in 1891, whereas it had been a town and a village before that. A lot of things happened in this town in the 1890s that changed the character of the town. But many of the things persisted, many of the attitudes and beliefs of the town in the earlier 19th century persisted through. So that I have found it a very interesting study, as I said, though, done hit or miss, and on the basis of curiosity. I started reading Oregon histories to learn something about Oregon history, and I wanted to tell you about a few of the interesting ones, some of them of historic importance. The oldest Oregon history that I know of, the book, is Gray's History of Oregon. It's posed here, yes. And this is a copy of Gray's History of Oregon. It was published in 1870. This copy is autographed by Sidney Harper Marsh. Apparently Gray gave him a copy, and Marsh autographed this book. This is in the rare book room in this library, which is back there just beyond the entrance doors. The title of this is A History of Oregon, 1792 to 1849, drawn from personal observation and authentic information by W.H. Gray. Now this is true. He was there through the whole time. He was in around here and taking active, in fact, interfering part in the setting up of the government and the early history of Forest Grove. It's a fascinating book to read, providing one remembers that he is biased and very opinionated and passionate about everything. But it's very lively and well worth reading. He has two villains, the Hudson Bay Company and Catholic priests, so that what goes wrong, you see, was caused by... But once one discounts that, it's quite an interesting book, as I say, first-hand observation. It has interesting descriptions in it of the early settlers at Forest Grove. He used to come here fairly often to visit these people in the 1840s. Another very interesting book, not so much for the history, is this book of Hines's History of Oregon, which is in the library here. And the fascinating, this book was owned by Fred Lockwood, the man who wrote a lot of historical things for the Oregonian. And in the front of it, this is a book of biographies that were done by interviews. Someone came around here in the 1880s, I estimate, from who is live and who is not in the book and this kind of thing, and interviewed people so that there are interesting accounts from the subject himself 30 years later after the pioneer days in this book. And the interesting thing is that somebody in the front of this book, which is also in the rare book room, there is a list of all the biographies that are in the book, and somebody has gone through and put a pencil star opposite all the people who lived in Forest Grove and most of the ones who lived in Washington County. A great help when you're doing research and hunting for books. Now the book that I, the history that I like, two of the histories that I like the best are one by Clark, History of Willamette Valley, which must be here, yes, here. This doesn't tell you hardly anything about Forest Grove, but it tells you a lot about what life was like in Oregon in the 19th century. And then the book by History of Oregon by Carey, which is the standard reference that you look things up in. But the trouble was that you learned very little about Forest Grove. There is about one paragraph in each of these History of Oregon on Forest Grove, and they all say the same thing. They say that Reverend Harvey Clark came here in 1845, which is partly true, and that he and Alvin Thompson Smith and Tabitha Brown started a school, Colleton Academy, which was probably the second or third formal school in the Oregon Territory at the time, and that Colleton Academy was one of the best, earliest schools, the best school, and it drew people to Forest Grove. All of that is true. Period. That's all there is about Forest Grove in these various Oregon histories, which doesn't get you very far. Well, it happened that after that, the next book I read was Men of Shampooey, over there. This was written by Carolyn Dobbs, who was the wife of the president of Pacific University, and she, I gather, belonged to the DAR, and she wrote biographies of each of the men who was supposedly at the meeting in Shampooey when the Oregon government was framed. This was on May 5th and May 6th in 1843. And these men's names are listed on a monument that the DAR put up down in the Shampooey State Park. And there are biographies of all of them, and pictures of many of them are in her book. And one of the thrills, there have been a lot of them that I got in this study, is that when I finally got on to A.T. Smith's diary, which I will come to in a minute, in his diary it says that on May 5th and May 6th, 1843, he is right here planting potatoes. He is not down at Shampooey helping to set up the Oregon government. And when I wrote this to Mr. Benson, he wrote back and said, yeah, well, he was glad to hear that, but he suspected a number of those men that were on the monument, whose names are on the monument, were not really there. Because they're, strange to say, this is the most important single day in Oregon history, probably 2 days. And either nobody took minutes, or whoever took minutes never did anything with them. And there are literally no minutes of what went on at Shampooey. There were men that 20 years later tried to remember what had happened, which is not a very reliable thing. Then I got interested in Joe Meek, who is a great character. If you want to read about one of Oregon's most delightful citizens, you read this book by Toby on No Man Like Joe. It's a biography of Joe Meek, and very interesting. Well, this was the fluke that meant the most to me. In this book, there is one sentence that says that in 1846, Joe Meek drove and friends drove four wagons of wheat over to West Quality Plains, which is what this was called, to the new mill built by Joseph Gale. And then there was a number for a footnote, and I looked at the footnote, and in the footnote it said, diary kept by Alvin Thompson Smith from 1840 to 1885 in the vault at the Oregon Historical Society Library. So, Alvin Thompson Smith is the first settler of Forest Grove. So ever since then, I ran onto that about 10 years ago. When I have a free day, I take the bus into Portland and work in the Historical Society in their vault room, where they bring out these diaries. They're little books about this size, a pocket diary, and he writes in India ink, which has held up fairly well, and he's not too terrible as a writer. I read it with a hand lens and take notes on it. At first, when I got there, I found that there was a typed copy of the diary from 1840 to 1846, and I figured Toby did that. So then I did the same thing, verbatim, everything, from 46 to 53, and there are copies of these two typewritten scripts of the diary here in the rare book room. These are right here if you want to look at them. Since then, I found I could get about 2 years done, read, in the diary and notes taken in one trip to Portland. So I'm now up to 1874. I've got sidetracked on a lot of other things too, and haven't got it to the beginning, which is what I really want to do. But this is what started me on Forest Grove history, and it turned out to be a very interesting experience. Alvin Thompson Smith was a farmer from Illinois and a very religious man and he was 39 years old, and he heard Harvey Clark give a speech, a lecture at a church, saying that there was a great need for people to go west to the Oregon Territory to be missionaries to the Indians. So Smith decides he wants to go, and in his diary, in successive days, I thought on going west to the Rockies. I thought some more on going west to the Rockies. I decided to go. These are successive days. That's about what the entries were be like. 3 days after he decided, he goes and tells Clark. Then he buys cloth and has the women of the town that he knows making clothes for going west to be a missionary to the Indians. And then he goes to the next town and persuades the Sunday school teacher in that town to marry him, because the man had to have a wife to go west in those days. And they left in about a month, Harvey Clark and A.P. Smith and another man. Named Little John. In the diary, it gives an account of the trip across the plains. There are a lot of these around for a lot of different early settlers. They went, rode horseback, and they had a wagon with them, the first wagon that ever came to Oregon. A.T. Smith brought from Illinois. They went up to Whitman's Mission, and they stayed there for the first winter and worked with the mission, and Smith worked with Spaulding. The following fall in 41, that was 1840 when they came, the fall of 41, they rode horseback down here, these three couples, and A.T. Smith and his wife, A.T. Smith, explored the Tualatin Valley. They camped over east of Hillsboro. They explored the Tualatin Valley and decided to settle over here, partly because it looked like good farmland. It had carried grass up to their horses' bellies, is what the description was of this good farmland that there is here. And also there were several Indian villages here along Ritchie Road, and then also all down along the Wapato Valley, along the shores of Lake Wapato. And his diary is very interesting to read. You learn about how he fell trees and dug the fir and felled the trees and built himself a cabin in October, November, and December. And every day he says what he does in his building, and it said, rained hard all day. All 3 months, it rained hard while he was building the cabin. Then during the winter, he makes his furniture, he makes plows, harrows, rakes, wagons, so forth. And he plows, and where he settled, I forgot to tell you that, where he settled was down south of 12th Street. All the land south of 12th Street between A Street and Maple Street. These are the present streets. From 12th Street on south to the Tuolumne, Gales Creek and the Tuolumne, is the land he settled on. And this proved to be very good land for raising wheat. In the Forest Grove newspaper in 1874, there was an article about all the wheat that had been raised around here, and it said, for example, over 150,000 bushels of wheat had been taken off of A.T. Smith's land in the 30 years that it's been planted in wheat. The growth was so good that they planted 1 year and then harvest for 2 years off of one planting. And the average was 50 to 60 bushels an acre without any input of fertilizer. That's how good the soil was when they came here. And this was true not only south of town, but also north of town around here. It, his diary is often kind of boring day by day, but you get a picture of the life of the whole time. And then after I came back from the day in Portland's reading it, I go down and down to 12th Street and walk down and look out at the land that he looked at, because you got such a feeling of having been there. And you learn a lot of useful history, things that, as far as I know, no one else around here has known before, because year by year, he says, so-and-so came, I took and stayed with me. I took him out to look at the country. This is when they go around to find things to take up this land. Then this person, he helps this person take up land, cut the trees, build his house. He gives him seed and food to get them through to their first crop. And so that you learn a lot of the people who came here and to the other plain, which is what he calls the area from Hillsboro East, East Tuolumne Plains, he always refers to the other plain, or down in the Yanhill Valley, so that you find out who came here, when, approximately where they lived, by how long it took him to go visit them. He played a very important role in the history of this region, and a minor role in history of Oregon. He was the first magistrate in this. He was the magistrate for the Tuolumne Valley in this first organization of Oregon government in 1843. He was the first postmaster of Forest Grove. And there is here a picture of the log cabin on his farm that was the post office. Here it is there. It was down just south of where Garrigus Lumber Company is now, is where the post office was. We went to probate court the first Monday of every month. As far as I know, that's the first information as to when probate court started and when it was held. He refuses to pay his taxes the first year because he doesn't believe in being forced to pay taxes. It should be voluntary. So then they won't let him vote when the first election comes up. So then after that, he pays his taxes. So many interesting things like this. He's the one that got the first church started here. In 1845, the first Congregational Church was started here. And A.T. Smith was the one that persuaded Harvey Clark to come here and do that. A.T. Smith was on the board, and he was kind of the treasurer and business manager of Tuolumne Academy when that started. So that he built the buildings and repaired the buildings and butchered the beef and gave them the potatoes they needed and all that kind. He did that kind of thing for about 5 years after it started. Then he apparently had a fight with people. This happened frequently. He had disagreements with them. But he played a very big role around here, and they lived here until 1885 is when he died. 1885 is where the diary stops. Now, from reading his diary and from other things that I was reading at the same time, I found how important it was to know who had taken the donation land claims and where they were. This is the basis of all land ownership in all of Oregon, this region in particular. And on the table in back of here is a map, is the map of all the donation land claims of this region. This land was taken up. At first, 3 years, the Smiths were the only people here. But then the land was taken up so fast that by 1855, 14 years later, all the land from Gaston to Banks, from Hillsboro to the foot of the Gales Peak over here, was all taken. And that's what's shown on that map back there. you could buy that map at the map store in Phillipsburg, whether it's back in print again or not, I don't know. Has, and I think the city library has it too, made by the Genealogical Forum in Portland. And those two are back on that table in the back, in which is listed the legal data that each man had to supply when he got his donation land claim, which was 640 acres a section for a man and wife. So there you get the date, the birth date, so you know the age of the man, you know the name of his wife and when he married her, you know when he came to Oregon, and you know where he came from, and then you know who were the witnesses that said, yes, we have known this person for 5 years and he has been living on his land in Oregon, which is what the witnesses had to say, so that you get quite a lot of information about people from those records of the donation land claims. Now, I must leave Smith, always a very interesting character, and this is how I really became interested in Forest Grove history, is from reading his diary. Since then, as I found more sources and have learned more about it, I have arranged the history into decades, simply so I could keep track of all the papers that were floating around in my house. So I now have big notebooks with notes by decades. So that what I'd like to do is to give you just a brief survey of what happened in the different decades that made a town, how a town happened to develop here. In December, it started Forest Grove as a town, or at the time it was West Quality Plains, started in the month of December in 1850, when Harvey Clark deeded 275 acres of his 320. That is, each donation land claim was 640 acres, but the woman owned half of it, and the man couldn't do anything with her half. So he, from his 320 acres, he donated 275 acres to the trustees of Colleton Academy, with a part of the land to be a part of the campus. And the upper north edge of Clark's claim is somewhere just about between here and Marsh. That is, it's about the level of what is now 21st Street over here. So from there, that part of the campus, from there down to Pacific Street, Clark donated to the core of campus. And from there on down to the north edge of 16th Street, between A Street over here and Hawthorne Street over here in directions. He donated that land to the trustees with the lots to be sold and the money to be used to pay the teachers. Now it happens apparently in the first decade, very few people had any cash or much money in the 50s. They did have gold, the men that went down to the gold rush. But part of this land was used to pay the teachers. For example, Sydney Harbor Marsh owned a big strip of land that the Hulls live on now, down on the south side of Filbert, 17th from Hawthorne to Filbert. Sydney Harbor Marsh owned that whole block there. Lots were, and which he was undoubtedly given instead of pay, because as I look at deeds, you find Sydney Harbor Marsh and Tabitha Brown owning land scattered all over town. Same thing was true of Cushing Eels, who was the first principal. So they obviously gave lots, you see, instead of the pay. Now this land is the beginning of Forest Grove, and it was surveyed at the time, but it wasn't platted officially until 1865. And in the College Museum, where there are lots of historical things, there is what I think is a copy, not the original, although maybe, of the plat, the 1865 plat of Forest Grove. And this is the land that Clark gave, and then later in the same decade, Elkanah Walker gave the rest of the campus from here on up to University Street, and then all the lots, the land west to B Street. Then another man, Thomas Naylor, gave the land from A Street to D Street west of here. So that was the size, and that was the size of Forest Grove when it was incorporated, which was in 1872. And here is a plaque, which is very interesting because it has a lot of useful interesting information on this. The names of the streets are on there. The streets are all named for trees. And our streets have had three different sets of names. Here I finally put together, for my own sanity, you see, comparable lists so that I could look at a list and know that, oh yes, 18th Street was, what was it, I forget, Larch. 18th Street was Larch Street then. No, that's 19th. Cypress, that kind of thing. You see, by comparing this list with this map. In addition, this map shows how the basic structure of the lots, the surveying of Forest Grove, particularly from here south to 16th Street. Each block is 400 feet on an edge, 400 feet square, and the blocks have numbers, and they're still numbered. This is on your deeds, you see, if you live in the old part of Forest Grove. Your land is in, like, blocks. Well, let's take Lansing Gimlin's house, you see. His land is not in the blocks of this. The east edge, only the west edge of Hawthorne Street is in the town. But the deeds are numbered by blocks from this map, and each block is divided into four lots. Each lot was 200 feet square on an edge. That's about an acre. And there were four lots in one block. The rumor is, what has been written, is that the width of the streets were determined by what it took for two hay wagons to pass each other. That determines the width, the original width of the street. And so that this 1865 plat, you see, enables you to take any old deed that you find, and, well, the ones that are in Central Forest Grove, and find out where it was by the block number, the lot number in the block. Many of the early settlers, apparently in the first two decades that they came here, they bought four lots, whole block, see, about 4 acres. And then they had a small farm up to around 1900. A lot of the land up for that the houses were on were small farms, and everybody had not only a big garden and an orchard and a big barn, and in which they had cows and horses and sheep and pigs and bees. And one of the major problems of the city government, as I have come to talking about the minutes of the city government meetings, is how to keep the cows off the streets. You see that time after time they pass an ordinance. Cows cannot be on the streets except between the hours of 8 and 5. And then everybody protests. So then they drop that ordinance. In the next spring they pass another ordinance. Cows may be on the street only between, these are literal ordinances, only between the months of May and August. And then everybody objects and that goes. When they finally settle the cows question, I don't know, but you may have noticed in the local paper just this week that in 1902, the origin of the women's club in this town was in 1902, a committee of women was set up to beautify the town, and their first job was to get the barns pulled down on Main Street. And so that was the first step in supposedly in beautifying the town. People didn't move here very fast. When Sidney Harper Marsh came out here from New England to this wild woods, he wrote back a very disconsolate letter to his relatives in the east, and he said that there weren't a dozen families within 5 miles in every direction of Forest Grove, where he was supposedly starting a new college and a new preparatory school. It's doubtful that the population by 1860 was probably around 100, not many more than that. In working through this history, the thing that interests me was finding what it was that drew people here. What drew people to the region was the rich farm soil, the rich soil, and the original settlers were mostly farmers. But from 1885 on, again and again and again and again, in reading the history, reading about people who moved here, they are men in their middle-aged men who have lived somewhere else in the Oregon Territory or the Washington Territory, and they move here so their children can go to Tualatin Academy. Again and again, this is given the reason. Even cases where the men worked in Portland, and there's a man who was a banker in Portland, and he moved his family out here and built the big white house that is now Marty Warner's Castle School on 12th Street. And he worked and lived in Portland all week and would come out on the weekend. But his wife and six children lived out here, so the children could go to Paul Academy. So there is no question, in my mind and from the evidence, that up until the mid-1880s, what made Forest Grove was Paul Academy. And the town then grew up around the campus, the central campus, and then the block of land that the Congregational Church now stands on. That was originally a whole block down to Pacific Street, and it was called the Church Square. And then it was sometimes called Town Square, and Forest Grove grew up around that as the center. And the business town, businesses were developed on around the Church Square and the campus, the north side of 21st, the west side of Main Street, and the south side of Pacific. That for clear up until in most of the 19th century, that was where the downtown was. Now, where do you find out who lived here when? It's a variety of sources, and you start what I did and what I had. I think the way to do it is to start a card file for each person's name, and then when you hear them referred to again, you add to the information on that card. A lot of the information that I got came from A.T. Smith's diary. Another source is the records kept by the First Congregational Church, which is another original primary source, which is now stored at the church, and they list the people who are members of that congregation. That was the first church congregation here. It was soon joined by, there was a Methodist church by the middle of the 1850s, a Baptist church a little before that. There were three churches here for a long time, almost to the end of it, just three churches. There are a good source of information are the lists in the histories of Fallen Academy and Pacific University, which they have here. The cemetery records are good sources of information, and in the bibliography I point out that the deed for the land which is now Forest View Cemetery and has been called Forest View Cemetery since, as far as I know, 1846. The deed, when Sarah Buxton deeded that land to the Congregational Church for a permanent cemetery, it was already had been an informal cemetery, and the records of the lots that were taken and sold and used are now kept in a vault, in a safety box out in the cemetery office, which is just east of the cemetery towards the back, Forest View Cemetery. The deed for the Mountain View Cemetery, which was originally called Union Cemetery in 1860, the Catchings deeded land to this organization, Union Cemetery, and the record, the sexton book of the lots that were sold and the lots that were used, Emma Nixon keeps at her house. She is now a secretary or something like that. And she has those records. Those records are very useful, and even just walking through the cemetery, where you see again and again a great big monument, and the man's name is on it, and his dates. And on this side is a wife, and when she died, often fairly young, and then several children who died very long, and then over on the other side there'll be another wife you see and several more children, many of whom died very young. The death rate among children was high. During the 1850s, it was Forest Grove was hardly even a village. It was called the Grove. Commonly, A.T. Smith in his diary speaks of the Grove. Even the Oregonian speaks of it as the Grove. In 1859, the post office finally changed the name formally to Forest Grove. I guess it had been called that officially, but locally, everybody called it the Grove, which interested me because at the time, the college students here were always referring to the Grove, often disparagingly, but it was apparently our old and original name. Was the Grove. In the 1860s, I know very little, well, some things about in the 1860s, from mostly putting it together in a variety of places, but there are no original records that I have seen Some of the information comes from me, some of it comes from later reports. In the 1860s, the plaque shows what the streets and the blocks were in town. There were two doctors, Dr. Bowlby and Dr. Geiger, but there was no dentist. There was no public school. And A.T. Smith played no school tax. The first public school, other than Twelfth Academy, was apparently 1870. There were three churches, as I said. The Masonic Lodge, which is still current in Forest Grove, was started in the 1870s. And Mary Collin has a history of it, which is where I got that information. There were three roads into or out of town. One was Baseline. It comes the straight part of the highway that comes runs towards Emma Nixon's house, not the curve Pacific now. That was Baseline Street. Baseline, it lies at about 21st Street in this town. That was a road in. Then there was a road called the Portland Lafayette Road, which was what is Elm Street now. It was called the Portland Lafayette Road. In the deed, when Emily Clark deeded her land, sold her land to Robert Painter, on that deed, there is the word, the Portland Lafayette Road, which presumably was Elm Street in town. Presumably then it went on and went down the east side of Wapato Lake, about where Spring Hill Road is now, is that road. Then there was a road that was built in the early 1870s along the west side of Smith's land and was called the County Road. So this means that was approximately where the old 47 was going out of town, about B Street. Those were the three roads. There was a weekly steamer on the Tualatin River, which carried, as I recall, 7 passengers and 70 tons of freight, something like that. And it didn't come clear to Forest Grove. It landed south of Cornelius, and people from here would drive over or walk over there to get on the steamer. The college built a second building. The first building, of course, was Old College Hall, which was built in 1850. Should have done that before. In the late 1860s, they built a second building that looks very much like Old College Hall, or looked very much like it, so much that it's hard to tell when you see photographs. If they're not both there, it's hard to tell which one it is. This was called the Academy Building, and it was here until it was located just north of this building, either in the road or in the garden back of Gates House, because that was here, and did it done in 1912? There are plenty of people here who remember. I think I've been told that it burned down at about 1912. 1870 is when the town really starts, because in 1872 the state legislature gave the town a charter, the town of Forest Grove. The first government was a board of trustees. 6 men were elected on for annual terms, and they were the board of trustees, and they elected one of their members to be president. And I have read some of the minutes of their meetings, a good many of the minutes. That big book over there, it's on that small table here. No, it's the one over farther. Those are the minutes of the board of trustees from 1880 until 1891, when the Board of Trustees became the City Council, when we shifted to our present form of government. And they are very interesting to read. And also there was our second newspaper was in 1873 and 74, and Mike Smith was able to borrow a microfilm that I could read this things from this newspaper. So I learned a lot about the town. The ads tell what stores were here, and there were about 10 stores, which I have a list of, that were here in the 1870s. They were all either on the north side of 21st or on the west side of Main, opposite the church square is where they were. And then two of them were on the south side of the Pacific. These were very interesting ads, and in this paper, they showed that there was a school. There was a public school, but it only ran when the town could raise enough money for it. In the one issue of this paper, it says there is no public school this year, that there isn't enough money, but the teacher of the public school is teaching in the city building, you see. So apparently when they didn't have the tax money, then the teacher ran a private school in the school building. At that time, in the 1870s, most people were still going to Tualatin Academy, and in late in that period, Tualatin Academy and the city school made a kind of an informal agreement that most children under 12 would be encouraged to go to the public school, and the ones over, 10, and the ones over 10 would be encouraged to go to Tualatin Academy. The result of this was that the local school, which was located where Central School is now, went only up to the 8th grade until the end of the 1890s. And they were arguing all this time trying to get high school grades, but there wasn't really any need for it because there was Tualatin Academy. So when they got it in the 19th century, 20th century, I don't know. The other old book over there are the original records of the minutes of the school board meeting, which are also very informative and interesting. Those two run from 1880 on. Now, one of the most interesting things, and then I'll really skip a bit, but I want to tell you about the first things, something that told seemed to me to say a lot about Forest Grove. In 1872, we got a charter. In January of 1873, they had an election, elected a board of trustees, and the first president of this town, a man named Ahio Watt. And they enacted at their second meeting, the first six ordinances. And I'd like to tell you what these are. These were from this microfilm in the newspaper. The first ordinance sets up the town government, the elections and the officers and their jobs. The second ordinance says that the town will always have a street superintendent, and that the street superintendent has complete control of all the streets and the gift for 10 feet on each side of every street, and nobody can cut down a tree without his permission. Lester Mulberry writes about visiting Forest Grove in the 1890s. He has several things he has written, and he talks about this ordinance. He says, this is why Forest Grove is so beautiful. This is in the 1890s now, more than other towns, because they kept all of the old trees. So that's the first act they did, other than setting up a government. The third ordinance says there will be no shows or circuses without the marshal investigating the character of the people in the show and charging them a license of $5. The fourth ordinance says there will be no alcoholic liquor given, sold, or disposed of. And you, the ones of you who have lots in the old part of Forest Grove, know that your deed is encumbered. It says on your deed that if liquor is sold or given to anyone on this property, the property reverts to the heirs of the people who own the land originally. The fifth ordinance defines what disorderly conduct is, which is forbidden. And disorderly conduct is really quite limited. No firing guns in town. The horses may not walk on the sidewalks. And you can't ride a horse faster than 6 miles an hour. And you can't help anyone else resist arrest. That's disorderly conduct. The sixth one, the sixth ordinance, is one that I'm about and was still working with at 1900 when I quit. And this is how to restrain the sheep, the cows, and the pigs on the streets, off of the streets, keep them off the streets. What they did and would reinforce periodically is then they would pass an ordinance that the town marshal, one of his main jobs, was arresting the stock that were on the streets. And then he'd take them, he had a pound around most of a block around the jail. And I kind of think that this block was the block that the city hall is now on. That's another number of men in town who knew about early Forest Grove in this century think that's where it was. They put this stock on this, in this pound, and then on Saturday afternoon they would have an auction, which they called the Saturday Outcrop. Okay, that was a lovely turn. And you had to go and buy your stock back. But I like those first six ordinances. I think it says a lot about us about this time. There is quite a bit of information in the 1870s. There was a special magazine published, one of these things where people go around and study a town and interview, talk to people in it and this kind of thing and put together a nice brochure. Well, the first one that I know of these is in 1879. There is a copy of it here. It's a brief thing, but it gives you a lot of information compared to what you haven't had up to this point about what's in Forest Grove. the newspaper has very interesting ads in it. There are a number of Portland ads, and one says, finger sewing machines have entered Portland. And there is an editorial in that paper calling attention to that ad and said, every man ought to get his wife a sewing machine. This was the editorial in our local paper. It talks about the town Christmas program. They had a joint Christmas tree in the Congregational Church or outside, I'm not sure which it was, and had it, the whole town had a joint Christmas party on Christmas Eve on the land around or and in the Congregational Church. Oh, I must finish with this. In the 1880s, there is, as I said, considerable original and authentic records, the school board and the city town record minutes. The Congregational Church has its minutes from 1852 on. The other churches I have not investigated. This is one of many things I haven't done. There is a history that the Methodist Church wrote up over there. And there are undoubtedly others. This one I really haven't looked into very much. Not much happened in the 1880s until the very end, 1889, when several men came here and started buying real estate, particularly south of town, and they very rapidly put up the first edition land, mostly. That was largely wooded. This is called South Park, and it runs from 16th Street down to 12th Street, and from A Street to Hawthorne Street, and it's the land that Emily Clark, it was her part of the Harvey Clark donation land claim, which she sold in 1865. Clark had died in 1858. She sold to a man named Robert Painter. He subdivided it in 1889, two men who then started the first bank here, C.M. Keith and Ed Haynes, bought that land and divided it up into lots, and in 1892 that was taken in to Forest Grove. That was the first addition in size in land of Forest Grove. And that was done at the same time that the town applied for a new charter, expanding the boundaries for one thing, changing the form of government to a mayor, five-man city council form of government, and changing the designation of the town to a city. And that charter in 1891 is, as far as I know, the one we're still operating on. I haven't looked into the 20th century. In the 1890s, everything changes. Things really start to happen here. That is, the population in that decade of the 1890s goes up from 600 about to 1,000 or over 1,000 in that one decade. This is way beyond anything that had happened before then. The city council started planking some of the streets, and owners of property lands were urged to build sidewalks on their own. The streets that weren't paved had crossing mats, horizontal planks woven together, I take it, with wire that they put down in the winter so people could walk across the muddy street, and then they rolled them up and put them in storage. And this was still true into this century, I think, and they were these crossing mats that they had storage in the summertime. During the first few years, they say they got a new charter, they got a bank started. They, in 93, they got streetlights, and they were constantly working on roads. The telephone lines were laid in 1894, and in 1895, the city got together, they had a public meeting, they said, we need good potable water and we need electricity. Let's build the plant and the city keep on owning it. And they had a meeting, and they, as I recall, there were 80 voters. No, I forget. I should take that back. I forget the number of voters that were at this meeting. All but two of them voted for a $30,000 bond issue to build a city power company. And in less than about a year, a little over a year, they built the city power company down on, near the bridge over Gales Creek, down on B Street, is where it was. And this was supposedly for good potable water and electricity. Well, there was a pump that pumped the water out of Gales Creek up into a water tower that was about back of where the bus station is, or Forest Grove, the First National Bank.
But that water was not good potable water. It was all right for putting out fires, and that's what it was used for, too. And it was probably used for irrigation. I don't know that. But Cicero Smith says that it wasn't until 1912 when Forrestal went up to the creek up on the top of Gale's Peak that they got good, wholesome water. But this power company was a great success. Electricity was put into the street lights, the buildings, houses were wired for electricity, and for the first time in that I've been able to find forever, this city had more money than its debts occasion. And up until this time, they have always paid for everything in warrants, and they would be paying off the bills, and they